Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today, I have a really interesting guest on. His name is Richard. He's done many, many, many things. And he has written a couple books, and I read his last book that I just got. So, Richard, without hesitation, let's bring you on, and please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who Richard is.
Hi, Nancy. First of all, thank you for having me on your show.
Very well.
I am Richard Omura. I was born in Japan. I am of Japanese blood, but my dad was from Maui. He was in the U.S. Army, and my mother's a national, regular Japanese, and of course, they got married, and I was born.
But being like that, you actually got to discover two different cultures because you got to have the Japanese part and also the American part. So out of those two, which culture do you actually relate to the best?
Actually, you know, that was a conundrum when I was younger because, you know, there were two sets of values and two different cultures, and I had to kind of waffle back and forth until I got older, and then I you know, told myself, you know what, I'm just going to say that I'm a citizen of Earth.
That's a good one.
And so that's when my viewpoint kind of expanded. I said, I don't have to stay in this pigeonhole, this category that people put me into. I can expand my whole worldview.
See, and that, Richard, that is very, very important because there are many, many people who are very much fixed in where they're at, whether it's through belief or, you know, culture or whatever. And really, your statement about being a child of the Earth is actually much, much better because that's what most people should really try to create for themselves so that they're more balanced. So that was pretty interesting. So, you know, go ahead, because you've done a lot of things. So.
Oh, yes. You know, and the interesting thing about me being in Japan, too, wasn't just the fact that I was an American in Japan, but it was basically, well, the fact that my grandfather, originally came from Japan to Hawaii, and he was a farmer. Very, you know, the bottom rungs of the totem pole, so to speak. And then he came to Hawaii, and my dad was born, and he was in the U.S. Army, and he went to Japan. And it's almost like, you know, the conquering hero from another country, but he originally came from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a kind of a paradox there. And so that was an expansion, and I had to figure out who I was because of that. And then I went to Hawaii to go to college, and I lived there for quite a few years. And as you know, many of you know, Hawaii has different cultures and different races and things. So my worldview expanded even further. And but when I was in Japan, something changed my life. Then that was I had a brain tumor when I was about 8 years old, and I had surgery. And that changed my life to a great degree because it that kind of changed my life in this, and not just physically but psychologically, because what the brain tumor did was it kind of stunted my growth a little bit, but then I had to take medication to compensate for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to kind of figure out who I was. And I also, you know, I have a book called Katsugen, which is based on a Japanese self-healing technique that I learned when I was in Japan to cope with this problem.
Can you tell us a little, I'm asking you this question, Richard, because the Japanese have got a lot of different healing techniques that we really could use here, but because we're so prescription conscious, I guess. You know, people choose to take a pill instead of anything else. So explain a little bit about that technique. And then after you've done that, maybe explain a little bit about the Japanese healing in general, because it's actually wonderful and marvelous.
Sure. The healing technique is called Katsugen Undo, which actually means primal healing exercise. And what it does is it uses movement to exercise the involuntary nervous system, or you know, it's also called the autonomic nervous system. It's the part of your body that that is a, like a self-defense mechanism. Something gets stuck in your nose, and you don't have to think about it. You automatically sneeze. Something gets stuck in your throat, you cough, and things like that. Your body takes care of itself without you having to actually, you know, intellectualize it and say, oh, should I cough or not? Because by then it'll be too late and you might die or something. So basically what this movement does is it exercises that. But, you know, it's like a contradiction in terms, because how can you voluntarily exercise something that's involuntary?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most difficult part, because it's so easy that it's difficult. In other words, it's more of a letting go. So much of, not just Western, well, industrialized culture, you know, the thing is to grasp things, to put your finger on it, you know, to nail things, to kind of like make it your own. But the whole thing about this is to not to do that, but to, conversely, to just let it go and let the natural God-given system in your body to take over and fling off those toxins through movement, through free movement. And our society kind of, you know, ever since we were kids, it's been trying to tell us that's not the thing to do. The society tells us our brain is the dictator, is the main thing. We have to go by our intellect, and we have to suppress and control our bodies, because the common wisdom, so to speak, back then was, you know, you have to, the body's nasty, it does beastly things, so we have to control it or it's going to ruin our lives. But this thought is that the body isn't like that. There's nothing that the body does in its natural condition that is negative. It's doing these things because nature made it like that. And our minds tells us, you know, to not to do these things. Like, for instance, don't belch if you're in church. You know, those kinds of things. Men have to act masculine. Women have to act feminine. And it kind of makes us robots of our mind. And it's like kind of like the bouncer in a nightclub. If you keep telling the bouncer, no, don't bounce this guy. You don't have to kick him out. Go ahead and take a nap. Pretty soon, you know, people come in and the bouncer doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with our body's self-defense mechanism. If you keep telling it, oh, no, you can't do it. You can't move this way. You can't belch. You can't break wind. You can't do any of these. Then pretty soon the body gets very dull, and those self-defense mechanisms, the immune system and all that, starts to shut down. And that causes, you know, illnesses and stress. But the thing to do with this exercise called cuts again is, it's kind of like the shutter. When people go in and encounter or experience something that is not to their liking, that makes them uncomfortable, it's an automatic reaction to shutter.
Mm-hmm.
Your body moves. It does this shuttering movement, and that somehow takes care of the stress for that moment. And so I use that a lot to describe this movement, that our body every day, you know, since we're keeping it so locked in, so much like a robot, and we're telling it to do these things, even though it doesn't want to, you know, what helps is if we take even 10 minutes a day, let's say at the end of the day, to exercise the involuntary nervous system. And then if you do this, then for the rest of the day, you can be like a robot, or you can keep your body under control, but that part of your body that wants to be free isn't so, it's not so controlled, it's not so suppressed, because it had that 10 minutes a day. It's kind of like taking your dog out for a walk.
Right.
You know, if you do that every day, then the dog's happier the rest of the day. And so that's what basically that's how this works.
So you overcame, you know, the problem with the brain tumor. One of the questions that I'll ask you now is, with the brain tumor, I'm sure they did surgery, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Did it help you at all with your insight, your intuition, your enlightenment, whatever you want to call it?
Yes, it did, because by freeing the physical aspect of my my whole self, it kind of made way for the rest of me, my mind and my soul, to become freer.
which, you know, and I think is real important. You know, a couple of statements that you made is that people keep themselves locked down, which is the term I used. And I keep trying to get people to understand that if you keep yourself locked down, your body has no choice but to get sick, because that's not really natural, you know. And it's very hard to get people to understand, just to open it up and let it be free, even if it's just breathing. You know, people don't breathe right normally. You know, they take little short, shallow breaths instead of nice, deep, cleansing breaths. And they don't know how, you know, because they're not really taught that. You know, now you, you know, because you were in Japan, they have a lot of different techniques there that they use. And you went through many different kinds of religions and, you know, spirituality and science and all of philosophy. So, again, maybe explain to our listeners, and then we're going to talk about your book, but explain to the listeners, as far as the religion and the spirituality from Japanese to American, it's also different. I mean, we're trying to catch up, but it's very different. Is that true?
It is different, but I think that people in the United States have a misconception about the spirituality in Japan. There are many very spiritual people who adhere to the traditional spiritual path, so to speak, but there are so many that have rejected those, and they strictly just go according to science. And that's, and one of the reasons for that is because during, you know, after World War II, the emperor, who was actually considered to be God incarnate on this earth, and people believed that the emperor was God. Well, after the war, General MacArthur made him go on the radio to tell the public that he was not God.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that kind of took away a lot of the spirituality from a lot of Japanese people. You know, when they found out, well, I believe that this guy was a God, and all of a sudden, he's on the radio telling me he's not. So, you know, so they did reject that, but there's still a large portion of the I don't know if it's large, actually. You know, I don't have the numbers, but there are a lot of people who still have this innate wisdom that the Japanese culture has created or developed in the past few thousand years. And it's not, sometimes it's something that when I talk to them, it's innate. It's like they don't have necessarily a theology, but they have this sense of being connected with everybody, because that's very strong in Japan, the feeling of interconnectedness in the country. And I think it does show in various ways. So go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and we're different here, because a lot of the people are very disconnected, you know, with family and stuff, which is unfortunate, because I think it's real important to be connected. You know, now, you've also done some transcendental meditation. Can you explain what the difference is between the TM versus just regular meditation, if there's a difference?
Sure. Of course, I don't know what you mean by regular meditation, because, you know, that's one of the topics in my book. Because, you know, if you tell me this is a coffee cup, and I've got a coffee cup, and we know exactly what a coffee cup is. You say this is a television, you know, yeah, this is a television. I have one in my home. But when you say meditation, when people talk of meditation, how do we know that when that person's meditating, he's experiencing the same thing that I am when I'm meditating?
Mm-hmm.
So we can describe the techniques and say, yeah, the transcendental meditation has a technique of chanting mantras quietly within your heart, so that as you chant this mantra, it makes you delve deeper and deeper into your soul. And there are other forms of meditation, like, for instance, the Nichiren Buddhism mantra, where it's chanted out loud. And I've practice that too, and I found the difference between those two is that when one chants out loud, it's more of a we're trying to do something in the external world, for instance, to get a better job, to be more successful, things like that. If we want to really apply ourselves to our daily lives, I found that chanting really helped. As for delving into our inner realities, I found that the quieter, the stillness type of meditation helps more in that respect.
Okay. There was a beep, so I think we have a caller on, but let me just make sure. Is there a caller on the line?
Yes, there is.
And can I have your name, please?
This is Cindy.
And Cindy, do you have a question?
I do. Can you tell me, give any insight for me on job-wise, what you see for me? The job that I have, my boss has been, he hasn't been paying me. And
okay, Cindy.
Getting my money from him.
Cindy, I'm not really doing readings right now. I'm just doing an interview. In about a month, I'm going to only have myself on, and then I'm going to just do all readings, but not for this show.
Okay. So, okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I didn't realize that.
Thank you for calling, though.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry. The other thing now, you've done also many things besides the meditation and stuff like that. You actually call yourself an adventurer sometimes, and you swam with the dolphins, which is something that I would just love to do. When you swim with the dolphins, you know, is there a different feeling? Does the dolphins help? I mean, dolphins have been known to be healers themselves. So when you were swimming with the dolphins, did you, you know, feel anything or get any kind of energy from them?
Yes. Well, I've gotten to be friends with the dolphins, but I've never really had an experience which I thought was out of the ordinary with dolphins, but I have had an experience with whales.
Mm, okay.
And that was when I was working on this cruise boat on Kauai, and it's a double-decker boat, and during the whale season, we would go out there and view the whales for the tourists.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a law there that says that you can't go within, I think it was 200 yards of a whale. Maybe it was 500 yards. But it was, you can just park your boat and let the whale come close to you, but you can't approach within a certain distance. So that's what we would do. We would go and cruise out there, and we'd see a whale. We would get as close as we can, and then we'd just sit there, and it's up to the whale, you know, and he can do whatever he wants. And then once we were doing this, and the whale would come up, and I had a tourist lady right next to me, and we were talking, and the whale would go down, and she would say, "Wow, I wonder where he's going to come up." And I had no idea, basically, but I said, "You know what, I think he's going to come up right over here," and I pointed in this one direction on the right side of the boat. And then in about a minute, the whale pops up, and she goes, "Wow, how'd you know that?" I go, "Well, I don't know. I thought it was just luck." And then the whale goes back down, and she goes, "Well, where do you think it's going to come up now?" And I said, "Well, probably over here behind us." And the whale comes up right where I said it was going to be. And this happened about 4 or 5 times, and I couldn't believe myself. And she looked at me like I was some kind of a wise man of the sea or something, and I just had this, I don't know how it was. It's an intuitive feeling that the whale was going to come up there, and each time it was correct. And I really felt that I had this communication going with the whales, and that was really incredible.
It is, you know, the sea creatures, the ocean creatures, they're just fascinating, and you know, I think that they're really great. The thing that's really hard is that a lot of people, you know, don't really get the opportunity to experience stuff like that, you know, and I think it's kind of cool. Now, let's talk about your book. It's called The Whole Universe Book.
Yes.
So how did you come up with that title?
Well, I came up with about 4 titles, and that was the one I settled on.
Okay.
The reason is because the topics are so diverse and so all-encompassing. It has to do with not just the material universe, but also the spiritual universe, and not just the Western religious thought, but Eastern, and and not just science, but also spirituality. And so I was looking around for some titles, and one was, I think one of the titles was called God, Gaia, and Us. Gaia meaning the planetary organism. And so, well, to make a long story short, I came up with the Whole Universe book to kind of like instead of the whole earth, you know, the phrase the whole earth is fairly common, so I decided to just make it the whole universe book.
Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the title is Navigating Time, Space, and Spirit with the Awesome Human Vehicle.
Yes.
Which I thought was very interesting. Could you give the listeners a little synopsis about the book? Not that we're going to give the whole thing away, but a little synopsis about it, and then we'll go into detail and I'll ask you some questions.
Sure. Well, I use the metaphor of a vehicle, of a car, going from one destination to another, or from one location to a destination. And I use that analogy for the human being and the body as the vehicle in which we are in, and where we start from and where we go to. And also the terrain. I talk about the parts of the human vehicle, the body, the mind, the soul. And I also talk about the destination. And along the way, the terrain that which we have to cover in our vehicle and the problems that we might encounter and how to get over those problems.
The very first chapter, you have in there the big assumption as a subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, first of all, your book is very, very deep. So reading it one time, it's not going to, most people, I don't believe, would be able to, you know, get it all in. So it takes a couple times, but the very first part I found, you know, very interesting because you were talking about how the big assumption is that we're alone.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you went in to describe how they still are trying to find other beings outside of our own Earth universe part here, and they really have not done that. So your thing was to turn it around and say, okay, maybe we're not alone. So can you explain a little bit about that big assumption so that the listeners can understand as we start to ask more questions?
Sure. The big assumption is that we are alone and there's no one out there, and we have to send these, like SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligences, these radio signals out there to see if they, you know, will reply. And all goes back to, you know, Copernicus and Galileo. They thought that the universe revolved around us. But, you know, turns out not so. The sun does not revolve around us. We revolve around the sun. So astronomically, things have changed. But socially, we still have that same mindset. We're here, and the whole universe is, you know, basically there's nothing out there as far as we know. And so we go by that assumption. And, science goes by that assumption, I should say, because many religions do not necessarily follow that. But I say that let's look at it the other way. Let's look at it from not the geocentric, the earth-centric way, but from the universe. If people were out there, and I believe they are, how would they look at us? And the funny thing is when I talk about being self, you know, a kid, a young child, usually is self-centered until he or she grows up old enough and starts to realize, no, that the world does not revolve around you, that you have to, you know, conform to the world and be polite and have manners and things like that. I think the earth is doing the same thing. It's kind of like it's a baby right now, the toddler, and it's very self-centered, not realizing that there is a huge universe outside of us.
Mm-hmm. It's really funny because when I hear people say, oh, there's no such thing as other, you know, others, there's cannot be ETs, they can't be this, they can't be that, and I go, really? You're so egotistical in your thinking that you don't think that there could be something else out there besides us?
Mm-hmm.
And then they get upset with me. But nevertheless, that's, you know, that's how I look at it, because to me, it would be very foolish to think that there is nothing out there other than us and that we're the only ones that have a brain. You know, I do believe we're probably the only species right now that might have emotional feelings like we do. But I also have, you know, my doubts about the human race because we're destroying so many things. And as you were going to say, you know, in part of your book, you said, you know, if you were going to associate with somebody, would you associate with somebody like us who is kind of in a self-destruct mode or, you know, not willing to make changes to help this planet survive?
Exactly. Yes. You know, you look at the world from an objective standpoint, and you see that, well, first of all, I'm sure some of the people listening have heard of the Gaia theory, which was proposed by James Lovelock in the 60s, that the Earth is a living organism. And there's a lot more scientific information that says that actually it is a living organism. Everything you see around us, the air, is filled with microbes. Everything you see around you is alive. The planet is alive.
Well, it is alive, and it's a living, breathing place. And
yes,
we as humans are basically destroying it. I mean, we're getting smarter, but it's taken us many thousands of years here. You know, and this planet has been here for a very, very long time. And yet everybody is afraid of 2012 coming because the world's going to explode and implode itself, which is really not true. But in my opinion, there will be a lot of change that does occur, and they need to occur if we all are to survive down the road.
Exactly, yes. And,
you know,
yeah, and I think the important thing that I wanted to get across in the book was that we, you know, you talked about the interconnectedness of the Japanese and that we need more of that. Not just the Japanese culture, but the whole world needs to be more interconnected. And what people don't realize is that we're not like bugs or creatures living on a rock. We are the Earth. In other words, you know, the things that comprise your body or your blood and muscles and everything that's part of you came from the Earth. Everything that makes my body up came from the Earth. Just a few months ago, it might have been a plant.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been an animal. I'm not a vegetarian, so, you know, but before that, it was part of the ground, and, of course, the sun's energies, you know, animated and everything. But really, there's no difference between you, me, and the other creatures and the other people on this planet because, you know, it's a part of you that was probably a part of me. In other words, a molecule, an atom that was in me a few months ago or a year ago, 20 years ago, got recycled and is now a part of you.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably have a part of you that was a part of me, and I probably have a part of me that was part of you, and same with everybody else on this planet. And so when you start to look at it in that way, the planet is not just a living being, it's a conscious living being, and we are the brain cells. Because we're the ones who have volition. We can think and choose and say we want to destroy, you know, this part of the earth, the polluted or whatever. Animals and plants, they can't do that. But humans, we have that power now. So we are, in essence, the brain of this planet. But the only thing is, the planet isn't together. In other words, you see a child, a human being, and that person has control over his motions. He can say, well, I'm going to go and do this, and if I'm going to use the bathroom, I'm going to go to the bathroom and not just all over the place. The planet itself hasn't developed a mind, a central mind that can do this yet. You have one faction going, no, we can pollute the planet, and the other faction is going, no, don't do that, that's gross. We have one country saying we're going to go to war, another country saying, no, let's have peace. The whole planet is a living organism, but it's at a very early stage. It's like a toddler that's, you know, basically crapping all over the environment and fighting each other, spreading diseases. It's not together as a whole. And once we can see that we are one and that we are the Earth, not just creatures living on the planet, but we are actually, not just in a metaphysical sense, but in reality, we are one. I am the Earth, you are the Earth. And once we start to have that consciousness as a planet, then those beings from outside will be willing to talk to us. Because right now, if they actually they're here already. You know, they realize that there's no sense in giving us new technologies because we're going to abuse it. which we've done, and we know we're going to do that. So they said, no, we're not going to give you new technology. We're not going to give you new science. But what we're going to do is give you new spiritual ideas, concepts, and values so that you can grow as a planet. And once you achieve this consciousness, this state of oneness as a planet, then we'll have someone to talk to. Otherwise, who are they going to talk to? They can't, you know, the United States? No. Not one government. They have to have a unified mind to talk to. And right now, the Earth is not that.
No, we're in a little bit of trouble here.
Oh.
And the thing is that we have been in trouble for a very long time because people, I really don't believe they understand the value of what we have here on this planet. And I think they really take it for granted way, way too often. And that's basically destroying us, not helping us. I mean, you know, everybody talks about how we've progressed so much. And I look around and I really believe that we have deprogressed because we haven't learned how to live as one. And that's our whole part of our being, is to try to be as one. And yet people seem, for whatever reason, either not to understand that, or they turn to other people telling them that this is what they have to do in order to be one, but of course they never achieve that. And so I think we're in a lot of trouble here. We're learning, but I think we're in trouble. I think people need to really be aware of what being one, as you just said, really is all about. Because I don't know if they really get it. They're starting
to. Yes, and I think the what's really important right now is the mother, the nurturing mother spirit. Because if we consider that the planet is a toddler, a child, what that child needs is a mother. I mean, we call the Earth our mother, a Mother Earth, but also the Earth is our mother, but the Earth is also our child.
Mm-hmm.
And so a child needs the mothering spirit in order to nurture the child and to bring it together as one. And I think that's going to be really important, very crucial in development of this world is for all the women to get together in this consciousness. And I think it's happening because there's more of, all around the world, women are getting more power to do things and getting more educated and starting to empower themselves.
Yeah, I think we need a balance between the masculine and the feminine, and we had that once, but through our progress, we kind of lost it somewhere along the line. Excuse me. So I think it's real important that we do get that back. Because the feminine part is actually the kind, loving, gentle part.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we're not in that kind, gentle, loving part. We're in self-destruct mode.
Yes.
Or, you know, destruct others, you know, not help others. You know, nobody else is better than we are. You know, we have this ego thing going on that is really destroying all the things that we were really meant to have here on Earth, as they call it, you know, heaven on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But we're destroying it. And it's being destroyed for several different reasons, you know, and not one thing is any more, you know, predominant than the other. But I think people do need to learn how to get back to the basics of Earth and loving yourself so that they can combine the two. Now, in your book, you also referenced the Ukraine, I think it's called Urantia book?
Urantia book.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Well, you know, I use the Urantia book as one of the evidences that there are extraterrestrial intelligences that are spiritual and that have been here and are trying to upgrade or uplift our spiritual status in the universe. And the Urantia book is very controversial. It's a really big book, and it's been in print since 1955, but it has some very mysterious origins. People don't really know where it came from, and it's very scientific on one side, and it's also very spiritual, so it balances the two very well. And it's been one of the sources of my inspiration. Unfortunately, you know, the thing is that some people... Well, many people who read the book, I feel that that they've been reading it for a long time, but they don't seem to understand it because they look at just the scientific intellectual side, or they may just look at the spiritual side, and people have a hard time combining those two together to make a whole. And I've done that. I've been studying that book for 30 years, and applied the teaching. Well, I don't know if you can say it's teachings because it's not that kind of a book. It has information, and it's not a self-help book. But if you use the information in it and apply it, you can get results.
Mm-hmm. And I went through that book too because I found it very interesting. See, I don't believe that we are alone. I believe that the ETs, whatever people want to call them, have been here for thousands of years, and they're waiting for us to catch up. And I agree that they're not going to necessarily help us out and give us too much info here because that'll only help us to destroy ourselves even more. But I believe that they've been here for a long, long time. And any ancient place that you go to, whether it's Egypt, Mexico, even here in New Mexico, they have, a lot of the Native American Indians, they all have drawings that would tend to show that there is something other than us here, because some of the drawings actually look like spaceships or helicopters. And these are like, hundreds of years ago when we didn't have any of this stuff. So, people really, in my opinion, have to get out of their ego in order to allow the true history that's going to be coming through. Now, you also have a chapter that's called The Personality Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that chapter pretty interesting because I really don't think a lot of people understand that. So can you just tell me a little bit about that chapter?
Yes. The personality is used different. The word personality is used differently than how many people take it. In this case, they use the word personality, which I took from the Urantia book, basically, to define that aspect of us that makes us a unified person. In other words, not just the body, not the soul, not just the soul, not just the spirit, not just the mind, but the personality is the matrix that connects everything together. And it's the one thing that is unchangeable. It's always the same. We can evolve in a million years. Everything, our bodies might change. Our souls might evolve. Even the part of us that is connected to the spirit might change, but the personality is the one thing that does not change. And it's kind of like, to use an analogy, kind of like a string, like a jewelry. You have different jewels, pearls and stuff on a string, and the jewels might change, but the string remains the same. So that's the one part of us. Some religions have called it the soul and spirit, but then there's a difference between that, because the soul is still a part of us, and the personality is something that encompasses everything that we are at this time.
Do you think that a lot of people know who they are?
I think most people have no idea.
I agree. But why would you say that?
Well, I think many people are on autopilot. There's a prayer about God, please help me against inertia. I don't know if you heard a prayer like that. And when I first heard that, I go, why would anybody pray about inertia? And then I realized, actually, that's autopilot.
Mm-hmm.
Inertia is what keeps us going like a robot, one foot after the other without really thinking about it. And it's the easiest way to live. You just put yourself on autopilot, and you just let yourself go. And then if you run into trouble, that's when actually you have to use your own volition and think about it. But most people, as long as things are going well, they don't get into that mode. They're on autopilot, and they just put one foot in front of the other and keep on going without thinking about the consequences.
Could you please give out your website so people can go and find you?
The book's website is thewholeuniversebook.com, and my website is richardomura.com. That's OMURA.com.
How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, the Whole Universe book, the actual process of getting the book together was maybe 2-3 years, but I got a lot of the material from presentations and workshops that I had done before. So I guess I can safely say it took my whole life to come up with this book.
It's actually a very good book. Like I said, it's very in-depth, and, you know, it's not a small book. So all I can tell people is when they go to read it, you know, read it, put it down, and then read it again. Because
yeah,
second reading.
Yes, I think I've had people who said they read it in one sitting, but many people said, you know, they just refer to it when they have a question that comes up in their mind. And actually, one of the things that I feel that's important is the concept of eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
I put that in the beginning of the book too, and say
right.
if that's the only thing that you're going to read about, just the introduction, then you should have this concept. And it's just a concept to mold, to think about, and that is that, you know, in our human brain, our minds, we have these memories of the past about, you know, things like, of course, simple things like the, you know, face of our mom and dad and of our husband or wife or girlfriend, or the important things are the information that we keep because it has value. And then there are things in the past that are not of so much value, like the color of our toothbrush maybe 5 years ago, or what we have for dinner, you know, 2 years ago, or you know, those things that are unimportant to us, the organism, we kind of discard and we forget about it. But the things that are very important and are of value to us, we retain. And so I use that pattern in the whole universe and saying that as humans, as beings, if we are important and are of value to the universe, then we are kept. But if we are not of importance, then we are discarded because it's really no sense in hanging on to us. And so in that sense, we can see that many of the religions, maybe they've been trying to tell us that the same thing, that we should try to be of value to the bigger organism, to the bigger whole. And when we do that, then, of course, we are desired and we are kept.
Mm-hmm. There was another part of your book when you talked about pleasure, because people's idea of pleasure, I think, is a little lopsided.
Uh-huh.
We'll be kind with that. A little lopsided. You know, they think going out maybe and getting drunk is mm-hmm. pleasurous. It's only pleasures for a while until that next morning when you wake up and you feel really bad, okay?
Yeah.
You know, but the idea of pleasure, I think people also misinterpret what pleasure really is because I don't know if they know what that is. So you explain it very well about pleasure. Can you explain it to the listeners, please?
Sure. Talk about pleasure in two different ways. There's negative pleasure or subtractive pleasure, and additive pleasure. Subtractive pleasure is things like if we're very tired, we need rest, and the rest feels pleasurable. If we're hungry, which means we're lacking something, we're lacking food, we eat, we add to it. I mean, we add the food because we don't have the food, and that gives us pleasure. So a lot of the pleasures in life are like that. Even alcohol, we create a craving, a kind of a vacuum, a lack. So when we drink, it makes us feel better. Even sex, we have our biological urgings. It drives us towards that, and we have to have the sex to fulfill that need. So it fulfills a need. That's what subtractive pleasure is. On the other hand, the additive is it's not a need. It's more like an expression, like music, art, conversation, things that we don't really have a physical need for them, but it gives us pleasure to add that on to our lives. And those are the more healthful and the more spiritual things. Meditation is very pleasurable, being with people, having conversation, social interactions, being creative in any way, art, music, those things are very creative and their additive pleasures. But then, since we are living in a material world and our body is material, I found that in my life, it's best when we combine the two. If I am hungry and I need food, the best way for me to have that pleasure, instead of just stuffing my face, which I've done, you know, when I was younger, I realized that it's more pleasurable if I eat better prepared foods done in an artistic way, and embodying spiritual values such as temperance, as control, having good quality food, and things like that. So if we balance the two, we can have pleasure that satisfies both the subtractive and the additive aspects of it.
People tend to want that self-gratification, that instant whatever. Is there a way for people to balance that instant, well, I got to make sure, I got to know that this is right? You know, is there a way for them to balance that so that they're not looking for that instant gratification of any kind?
I think we have to grow out of that. A lot of that has to do with our growth as a person. And I think when we're younger, we tend to want instant gratification. And then as we get older and wiser, we learn to put things off. We delay our gratification so that we can say, well, I'm going to work really hard, and then I'm going to party instead of party right away. And as we get older, I think we start to realize, especially when we become more spiritual, that pleasure is more pleasurable when it's intermittent. Because when we're younger, we do these pleasurable things, and when we get our wish and we can be or do pleasurable things every day on a constant basis, it starts to wear out and it's not fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people get into that situation, and then they become depressed because they don't know how to get out of that. They don't know how to have fun anymore because they used up all their fun credits, so to speak. So the best way is to keep all that under control and to use the delayed gratification and to say, well, I love doing this one. Let's say a person likes to drink wine or something, but you know, they can do it in a very tasteful, very wise manner, and they don't have to drink every day. Because I found I don't drink anymore, but when I used to drink, I found that if I were to drink every day, it was no longer any fun. I was just doing it to keep the willies away, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I wasn't getting any added joy from it. And then after I started to control myself, I realized that if I don't drink during the week and I just drink during the weekend, I enjoy it more. Then after a while, I realized that I don't really need to do that either, because I told myself, why do I need to even drink to get pleasure out of life? Isn't life pleasurable enough without that? And, you know, that's something that's a personal thing. Some people like to do that, and I find that that's no problem. Everyone has their hobbies and their likes and dislikes. But I think the whole thing is just to control that and using the delayed gratification and getting the most pleasure out of it by not abusing it and by not doing it all the time.
Why do you think people, Richard, have a really hard time with love and what love really means? And because most people don't like themselves, let alone love themselves. What do you think has caused that lack of love, like self-love, not in an ego way, but from a heart?
You know, that's a difficult question, because I know a lot of that has to do with the upbringing, and you know, scientific studies have shown that kids who are not loved by their parents, and a lot of them will commit suicide because they just don't have the things inside them. They're not wired to be loved, and they have no way of accepting love. But aside from those exceptions, I think most people can appreciate love, and a lot of times the love is covered up by insecurity. I see so many people who are so fearful and so insecure of themselves, and I was like that myself. And the way I dealt with it was by contacting the source of love through meditation. One can meditate on love. And that's what I did, was I meditated on the love within me, and I just focused on it and said, where does that love come from? What is the origin of love within my heart, within my soul? And after tracing it back, or I shouldn't say back, maybe inwardly, I found the source of love, which is God, which many people call, I'm not necessarily talking about the Judeo-Christian concept of God, but God as the creator, as the source of all. And once you get in touch with that love, it's just amazing. There's just so much love there, and you realize that you are loved, not for anything that you do, but just for being you. And I think once people realize that, then they can get rid of their fear and their insecurities.
Yeah, really, because I do like a lot of consultations, and one of the things that always comes up without doubt is how a person will think that they have to have somebody else in their life in order to have the love that somehow they're lacking.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they have fear of allowing somebody to come in because they've been hurt so many times before. And that's one of the biggest things I think people have a hard time overcoming, is that self-love that you're talking about, which is really kind of mandatory in my opinion. It really has to be there in order to let somebody else really come in so that there truly is a good love there. And I know people will disagree with that because they go, oh, no, this person makes me feel good. This person makes me laugh. This person. And my question to them is, what do you do for yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Chances are they can't answer it.
Yes, and when you trace back consciousness on its deepest level, all comes back to one. There's only one consciousness and one love. And when you see someone else and you see their love, their whatever it is that makes you feel good in their presence, actually that is a part of you. That consciousness is actually a part of you that you're resonating with.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to realize that it's accessible to them too, anytime, at any moment. And it's sure, some people make them feel better because they have that kind of a connection there that enables them to connect to that person's love, because that person has done it himself or herself. And I think the important thing is for each of those people that can feel this love to pass it on to others, to be able to let them know, you don't have to be dependent on me for this love. You can find this love within your heart, because that's the basis of the universe, of universe reality is love.
Mm-hmm.
As they say, you know, love is God, and God is love.
It's kind of a big circle. I always tell people it's really starts as an inside job and works its way out.
Yes.
You know, so that they get it inside. There's another part of your book where you said that when someone is facing death, that's when they start to live. Can you explain that?
Well, I think in my experience, when I was surfing big waves in Hawaii, when I went out there and I was very scared, fearful, and I came out of the water, and I felt so much more alive because I had come across this concept of maybe I'm not going to survive. And happens when we have diseases. I had pneumonia about 4 years ago, and when we're faced with that, life seems so much sweeter. I guess it's by contrast. In the battlefield, people say that, they've never felt so alive as when they're in the presence of death. And I think many of us have these lives where things are very not exciting. We're not constantly faced with life and death situations in our daily lives. And so we tend to take life for granted. And we tend to complain about the smallest things in our lives that make us uncomfortable. And, when you're faced with death, all these things come into perspective, and you realize all those little things are just that. They're nothing. We should be grateful of what we have, because everything around us is just so wonderful. Just the sunrise, just talking to people, having people that love you. We start to realize how marvelous existence is.
And that's true. A lot of people are starting to wake up to realize that now, and that's real important. Now, we only have about a minute and a half left, so could you give out your websites and the name of your book again, please?
Oh, yes. The Whole Universe Book is the name of the book, and the website is www.thewholeuniversebook.com. And I'm the author, Richard Omura. That's spelled O-M-U-R-A, and my website is www.richardomura.com.
Now, we have about less than a minute left. Now, you've written a few other books. Do you want to give us the titles for those?
Oh, yes. The Japanese self-healing method is called Katsugen, The Gentle Art of Well-Being, and that website is www.gentleartofwellbeing.com. You can also, there's also a link from my website, my personal website. And the other books are also accessible through my website. I have a spiritual science fiction called The Seven Circles, which is based on the Urantia book, and also The Tao of God, which is a restatement of Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching.
Are you got? Do you have plans for make for doing another book here soon?
Yes, I have. I'm debating what I should write about. I'm not really passionate about one thing right now, so I'm still searching, still looking up in the sky and trying to find out what it is I'm gonna get really into.
Great, Richard. Our time is actually up, and I want to thank you for taking the time to talk about your book and talk about yourself. It should give people some pretty good insight. Again, you know, I read the book twice, actually, to make sure that I understood it the first time.
Oh, great.
You know, and it's important, you know, so that people understand that. Don't just read it once. Read it two times, three times, if that's what it takes, but understand it, because it's actually pretty good, and it was written very well. So I commend you on that book.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, you're very welcome. You take care. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. And like I stated a little bit earlier, next month I'm going to be on the show all by myself, and I don't usually do this, but I will do this. I will be doing only readings on that show. So may God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk later. Take care. Bye now.